from the Ghost Knight Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
Karen Frazier and Rick Hale.
Oh, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
Karen Frazier and Rick Hale. That's right.
So are you going to bless us with a symphony of armpit farts here, Karen?
That was the whole plan for the show tonight. Welcome, everybody, to Paranormal Underground Radio. And tonight, Karen is going to do armpit farts, and that's going to be the whole entire show. So I hope
I can't wait.
I know. You know, funny story apropos of that is that there was this guy that I went to college with, and his name was Jeff. I'm not coming up with a last name, but that's probably not necessarily a bad thing. And this guy was the most amazing armpit farter I have ever heard in my life.
Frat boy, right?
No, we didn't have fraternities at the school that I went to. We didn't have sororities or fraternities. But this guy, the stuff that he could make those babies sing, it was amazing in a way that, and of course, it was always a lot more funny when you were really, really drunk, which I am right now. So there you go.
That's awesome. Well, there was that guy back in the 19th century. He was a French dude. His name was Le Petitmain. Mm-hmm. And apparently he could fart on command and actually fart out music. And people loved him so much that they would pay hundreds of dollars or hundreds of francs or whatever just to see this dude. And he actually has a body count going for him. He actually caused a few women to have to like faint and have heart attacks because they were so mortified by his farting techniques. It was great.
You know, I've actually heard of the guy before. Now that you mentioned it, that story sounds really familiar, and I don't know if it's something you've told me before or something that Techie McScience Geek comes up with in his worthless facts, which he probably has. It probably was. So I'm excited. We pre-recorded our guest interview on, was it Monday?
I think it was Monday night, yeah.
Yeah, I have no conceptualization of what day of the week it is at all.
So, time is totally relevant.
I know. So anyway, we pre-recorded it on Monday, and it was so great. We're going to be talking to Nick Redfern. Now, he's a dude that you found for us, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you're listening to the show and you haven't heard of Nick Redfern, I really do pity you because he's quite the prolific writer. He's a real Renaissance man when it comes to the paranormal. He's written numerous books, such as Three Men Hunting Monsters, which I actually read today that was being optioned for a movie for Universal.
Cool.
Yeah. So,
oh, great. Or,
you know, tons of other books on ufology, high strangeness, monsters. He's cool. So
you kind of have a little man crush.
I think I got a little man crush going on.
Yeah. Hey, and I have just a normal crush. Oh, he's got the greatest voice and the greatest accent. So it's a really interesting and entertaining interview. And I will promise everybody this: the guy actually freaked me out in the middle of the interview, and gave me nightmares, freaked me out, and that has never happened to me before. I mean, I've had, you know, the standard nightmares where I'm like standing naked in the middle of town as people are driving by pointing and laughing.
Now, was that when bats are attacking?
I was going to say, surprisingly though, you know, that nightmare occurred on Wednesday, and it was because on Tuesday I was standing naked in the middle of town while driving by pointing and laughing. So, you know, life imitates dreams, right?
Mm-hmm.
So guess what happened here this week?
What happened?
We had an earthquake.
Huh?
We had an earthquake.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard about that. How strong was it?
Oh, not very. It was like a 4.5, I think, is what they ultimately settled on. And it was a pretty good little rattler, though. I was sitting there, and my dogs were really, really hyper for about a half an hour afterwards. So earthquakes affect animals. I can guarantee it.
Oh, yeah, totally. And apparently John Travolta as well.
Oh, that's right. What was that movie? Phenomena. Was that the name of the movie, Phenomenon?
Phenomenon, yeah.
Da, 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 da.
So I got some big news. I was sharing it with you guys, you know, before before the show. Yeah. I have not had a cigarette now in over 48 hours.
I know. Yay, Rick. I'm really excited for you.
You know what, though? I was thinking the other day that, you know, I'm taking these those nicotine poly Krylex lozenges, and I'm thinking that on the morning of December 21st.
Those sound delicious, by the way.
Actually, it doesn't taste too bad. Okay. On the morning of December 21st, 2012, when the zombie attack comes down, because that's what's really going to happen, you know, to end the world. It's going to be zombie apocalypse. When they catch one of us, they're going to find out that we are all ex-smokers, and it was the Polycrylex nicotine tablets that turned us into zombies.
So I need to watch out for you when the apocalypse happens. Is this what you're telling me?
No, Cheryl needs to watch out.
Oh, totally.
No, zombie apocalypse.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I believe it, because one of our lightning round questions later sort of suggests that not only may we die by zombie apocalypse, but we may have gotten here because of zombie apocalypse.
Yeah, I saw that. That's
I know.
It's actually a pretty cool question. But, you know, I was reading something at coasttocoastam.com a few months back, and apparently some Scottish mathematicians have actually come up with a formula that said that there is a likelihood that one day zombies will attack.
I'm trying to remember if it was, they had in Discover magazine, they had the 30 surprising ways that our species may come to an end. And I'm not sure that zombies were one of them, but they probably should have been, huh?
Yeah, they probably should have been.
Oh, so, I'll be damned. Yep. Okay. So, hey, I had like last weekend, it was like uber paranormal weekend for me.
Cool. What do you got going on?
We went last weekend, NWPIA, which is the team that I investigate with. We did an investigation of an old 1907 hotel in Skycomish, Washington. And it was a cool place. And I think that our biggest danger was from the drunks from the bar next door who kept walking by and heckling us.
So, I would.
Yeah.
I'm a paranormal investigator.
There you go. Well, there was some really old guy who was probably 110 if he was a day, who came kind of creaking out, staggering out on his cane and said, "I'm going to go home and get me my .44 so I can shoot that ghost between the eyes."
Well, isn't that kind of Bert's plan? Because, you know, you guys do carry those guns and all.
That's because it's a wild, wild west out here, baby.
That's right.
That's right. And then the other thing that we did is then, so we came home, we spent the night up at Skycomish, and I slept for maybe about an hour, I think. And then South Sound Paranormal Research, which is a local group here in the town that I lived in, invited me down to the Lewis County Museum, which is an old train depot. Mm-hmm. And so after my hour and a half of sleep, we went and did that with them. And I fell asleep standing up.
I've actually done that before.
And my biggest fear was that I was going to hit the floor and I was going to wake up and people were going to be like waving their EMF detectors over the top of me.
We're going to capture her soul coming out of her body.
Really? I don't think anybody would have tried to dial 911. I think they would have just, you know, tried to see if what was, you know, wave their recorder. So, hey, I actually have Cheryl. You want to pop on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, I sent you a couple of EVPs from our Klondike investigation.
Cheryl Knight, ladies and gentlemen.
You did.
Cheryl Knight, our wonderful producer, tries as hard as she can to keep Rick and I on track. We're being really good tonight.
You are, except for the beginning of the show when you were talking about armpit farts,
and then Rick turned it into actual farts, and then I farted, and, you know.
Yeah.
With Monsieur Le Petamine.
That's right.
And then the zombie talk. I mean, seriously, I have enough worries, Rick.
Okay, so can we play those EVPs? I want Rick to hear them. He hasn't heard them, and I want you to hear them. And,
I guess
if people are listening, they can hear them, too. This is at the Klondike Hotel, it's a Klondike restaurant in St. Helens, Oregon, which is the place that last weekend, not this previous weekend, but the weekend before, I think, Tanner and I investigated with West Coast Ghost Hunters, and also we followed in the footsteps of the fabulous Ryan Buell.
So,
which is why all the mirrors were probably covered up with.
That dude really loves himself.
Hey, what's not to love, right?
That's right. So what was interesting about both of these is that these were not captured when we were investigating. They were captured when we were down sitting in the restaurant area, which we had set up as our command, and other people were up investigating.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
It just shows you can get them anytime.
So let's play them and see if I accidentally sent you, you know, like private tapes between Jim and I, or if I truly did send you EVPs. It'll be interesting. Here we go.
Here we go.
Did you hear it?
I heard a little voice, like a little kid voice, kind of.
Here's the thing. Yeah. I was the only female in that room at the time. Play it again. And I'll tell you after you listen to it one or two more times what it says.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I turned up my volume and I totally heard it.
Yeah, do you get what it says?
Well, Rick, do you know what it says?
No, I don't get what it says, but it definitely does not sound like Karen.
No. One more time.
Okay, let me pull it back over here. Yeah, that's really clear.
I think it's very clear what it says.
You want me to tell you?
I think it says, "Let me see."
Yeah. That's what I totally heard that.
I'll play it one more time now and see if you pick it out, Rick.
Yeah, please do. Yeah, I can. Yeah, I wouldn't call that a class A, though. I would call that a class B.
Okay, class B. All right. So, and then we have one other.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, did you get that one, Rick?
That was pretty
no,
clear.
It says it's that same kind of ha-ha-ha voice. So it speaks over whoever's talking. So you hear it say, ah, and then at the end it goes, ha-ha-ha. So, but it says words. So
okay.
We'll play it again.
All right.
Gosh, that's just creepy as heck.
No, there's so much background noise.
Yeah, I haven't run it through any filters or anything because I think it's really clear what it says. What I hear it saying is no, thank you.
Yeah.
All right, let's.
It's crystal clear to me.
Yeah, can I hear it again?
Yeah.
Sure.
All right, you ready with your headphones, Rick?
I got my headphones going. Yes.
Cool. Okay, here we go.
Oh, I got it.
Thank you is very clear.
No, thank you.
I got it
goes,
it that
no,
time.
And then pause, and then no, thank you.
Yeah, because the no went under. I actually, what's interesting is I start to talk, so you can hear me talk in the EVP. And mm-hmm. it's after I talk that you hear the voice say, no, thank you.
Yeah, I got it that time.
Yeah, so those are it. Those are my big, exciting EVPs from Klondike.
Yeah.
Now, people are going to think, Karen, though, because you're sitting around. Where, did you say you're at a restaurant?
Oh, it was an empty restaurant.
Oh, okay. That someone was saying no thank you to a waitress. But if it was an empty
restaurant. No, it was just us. We were the only ones there. We had set up base camp in this restaurant. And the restaurant is down on the second level. Then there's a basement. And then we were sending teams up to investigate the top two floors.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Are those the only two EVPs that you got that night, or
no? Those are the two that I have that were actually really clear. I have one of a woman humming when I was the only woman there. And if you've ever heard me sing, A, you would know it was not me, and B, I never hum because people stare at me funny.
Okay.
So there's a woman humming. There's one where I say something to Tanner, and then you hear a voice repeat after me, go, Tanner.
Okay.
So, you know, a few things like that.
See, now that's really, really awesome when you actually have one of the entities say your name.
Yeah.
When we did an Inhuman case with McHenry County Paranormal Research Group, and I actually have, like, this... I don't like using the term demon because I don't believe in demons, but like this inhuman actually like hisses my name. It was so cool. It was like, Rick.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I got another one that I can't remember what it says right now, but I got another one that was a whisper that was really interesting. But I always tend to be suspicious of whispers. I think that whispers are the orbs of EVPs.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, anyway. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when it comes to whispers, it's like I've always maintained the belief that when you're doing EVPs, that an entity is speaking from across a gulf of consciousness, and they may actually be yelling that right in your face, but you only get the whisper. So.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, I have to, I'm not sure. The whisper, it's very clear that somebody says something. I mean, it's one of the clearest whispers I've ever had, to the point that when Tanner listened to it, he said, somebody said that, but it didn't make a lot of sense that somebody would have whispered that. But it, so anyway, hey, so let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to listen to our totally super awesome interview with Nick Redfern. So you're listening to Paranormal Underground on Z-Talk Radio, and we'll be right back.
Hosted by Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today. Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Thank you. views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ztalkradio.com.
Hey, welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio, everybody. I'm Karen Frazier, and I'm with some other guy.
I am Raquel. My name is first for obvious reasons.
So, Rick, the other thing I just realized before we wanted to answer a question from the chat room, but before we go to that, you shared something other than the quitting smoking thing with us before the show as well, and that's that your baby's coming anytime now.
Oh, God, yeah, probably within the next 2 to 3 weeks. He's actually starting to make the descent, so...
So we have a guest host standing by.
I could not be happier. It's considering the fact that all that Jamie and I have had to go through over the last 7 years to get to this point. It's the most exciting thing of all time.
I know, and I get to go shopping for baby clothes, and God, I'm so excited about that.
Hey.
So, I know, woohoo! So, we had a question from God's Anime Fever in the chat room, and since we were playing EVPs and you sort of classified them, he wanted to know what the classifications of EVPs were. So go, Rick Hale.
Well, there's three classifications of EVP. There's A, B, and C. We'll start off with the C. With the classification, C is basically there might be something there, there might not be something there, there's a lot of hiss. With the classification of EVPB, you can hear something and make out words, but again, it's not quite as clear as day. Class A EVP, crystal clear, you can make out absolute words. Usually it's due to an intelligent response. That's the way I view the EVP classification system.
So those two were B, probably.
Yeah, there was a lot of background noise, a little bit of hiss. If you for me, if you actually have to show subtitles, then it just needs to be completely thrown out.
Right. Oh, so mine were not valid at all, is what you're saying?
No, they were valid, but they were definitely. I'm really sorry to say, Karen, they were not Class A EVPs.
I know. I've heard some Class A EVPs, and while they don't sound exactly like somebody like you and I sitting here talking, they're pretty spectacular, and they're pretty rare too. They're pretty hard to come across.
Yeah, they are, especially when you're dealing with an intelligent entity. I'm sort of the mind that when it comes to residual, that those are basically your Class C EVPs. Nothing really comes across. You may have a visualization of the entity going about its business, but otherwise they really don't show up on any kind of equipment.
Got it. Okay, so here's the deal. We get to sit back and listen to our own fine interviewing skills and chat with people in the chat room, because we have a great interview coming up. We're going to be listening to Nick Redfern, who's an author. And then later, we have Michael Kravchuk, who is the Ghost Gadget guy, and he's going to be sharing some full spectrum stuff with us, I believe.
Awesome.
So, yeah, Cheryl, let's go to that interview, please. Go.
Okay. Hey, everybody. This is Dale and his sidekick, Karen Frazier. How you doing, Karen? Number two, baby.
Who was on national television last week? Was it you or me?
I was on the Oprah Winfrey Show when I was 15 years old. So
I'm more relevant now.
Who's more relevant than Oprah Winfrey? All right. Well, hey, everybody. This is actually going to be a pre-tape show, and tonight we have a really interesting guest, a regular Renaissance man of the paranormal field, I suppose you could say, cryptozoologist and ufologist Nick Redfern. Those of you who aren't familiar with Nick, he's quite the prolific writer. He's written such books as Cosmic Crashes, A Covert Agenda, Strange Secrets, Body Snatchers in the Deserts, Three Men Seeking Monsters. One of my favorite things is the British Bigfoot, his book Man Monkey in Search of the British Bigfoot, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. He's also appeared on a couple episodes of Monster Quest. Is that correct, Nick?
Yeah, that's correct, Rick. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. Hi, I love me a Prenaissance man. See, that's it's paranormal renaissance. It's Prenaissance, right?
Prenaissance.
Yeah, I just coined a new word.
So, hey, Nick, Nick Redfern, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks, Rick, and thanks, Karen.
Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to talking to you. Or actually, letting Rick ask you a lot of questions and trying to get a word in edgewise is what it sounds like it's going to be. But I'm good with that. I'll sit back and listen.
Nick, is it any wonder that I'm number one?
I'm not even going to get into that conversation.
You're a wise, wise man, Nick.
So, Nick, you know, first thing that I wanted to ask you was how did you go from writing for the British fashion and music magazine Zero to writing about monsters and UFOs and UFO cover-ups and all that? Did you have some kind of personal experience that led you into this field?
I actually didn't. I mean, when you talked about Zero, that was a magazine I used to work on when I was about 17 to about 19. Mm-hmm. And I still actually do a lot of people don't realize, but I still do a lot of that sort of work now, like mainstream journalism.
Mm-hmm.
But everything from sort of rock music reviews, CD reviews, and just mainstream feature articles for newspapers. But what happened was that when I finished school, I began working on this sort of entertainment / music magazine in England called Zero.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a couple of years. But what had happened was that when I was about 6 years old, my mom and dad took me on holiday to Scotland, and we spent a day at Loch Ness, and my dad told me this story about the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, even at that age, when you can't necessarily appreciate, you know, what the whole intricacies, I guess, of something like the Loch Ness Monster.
Right.
You know, the idea that there were strange creatures or monsters living in Loch Ness sort of appealed to me. And I guess at that age, you sort of equate it with stories of monsters in the closet or under the bed, you know. But when my dad told me the story, it sort of fired up my imagination. And as I began to get older, you know, I guess while some of the kids were reading the British equivalents of things like the Hardy Boys, you know, I was reading John Keel and Gray Barker and Joker and things like that.
Yeah.
So that sort of got me interested in weird stuff. Then when I'd done a couple of years on the Zero magazine, I thought, well, why not try and combine sort of like a journalistic approach, but with the interest in weird stuff and research and write about that, and, you know, in the same way that I'd been employed on the magazine. So that's sort of what really kicked me off. Not a personal encounter, but, you know, personal exposure to the Loch Ness mystery, I guess, at a very young age.
Right, right. Yeah, you, I would have to say that you're, you know, quite the Renaissance man. You, in your books, you cover a wide variety
Renaissance man.
Oh, Prenaissance. Excuse me, Nick. We have to use Karen's lingo here. you know, in your books, you cover quite a wide variety of phenomenon. Everything from monsters to, you know, alien abductions or whatever, but there's one monster in particular that, you know, you seem to know quite a bit about, and people in this country, which of course now you live here, living in Texas, but we're not really familiar with, and that's the British Bigfoot. How far back does this legend go? I mean, when people think of England and cryptozoological creatures, they think of alien big cats, of course, never a Bigfoot. How far back does this reports of this creature go?
Well, the reports actually go back a very long time. The earliest definitive report of it, like not so much a Bigfoot report, but like a hairy wild man, dates almost back about 1,000 years to a little town, or little village, I should say, on the east coast of England called Orford, where supposedly this sort of hairy wild man was taken, it was captured and taken to Orford Castle. And held there for a couple of years, and supposedly it looked very human-like, but covered in coarse hair, and acted in a very wild fashion, but after a while supposedly became almost like tamed, if you like. Now, of course, you know, as you pointed out when you sort of raised the question, that people outside of Britain probably aren't aware that there is like a culture and history of these type of reports, and certainly one of the most famous ones, which I've investigated and wrote a book about, the so-called man-monkey of a little village called Ranton in central England. One of the reasons why I wrote about this was because it's actually not too far from where I grew up. I grew up about 15 miles from the city of Birmingham, which is a very industrialized area. But when you get outside Birmingham and head northwards, you're literally into like deep, thick countryside and heavy forest land and woodland.
Right.
And it was on the fringes of this sort of heavy forested area back in 1879 that we had the first sighting of this creature that back then became known as the man monkey. Mm-hmm. And there's a large canal bridge in the area, like a very old canal, about 200 years old, which, and the entire area, the village, the buildings, everything hasn't really changed since, you know, back then. It looks like something straight out of Harry Potter or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this report of a man crossing the bridge late one night in January 1879, and he said this large monkey-like animal, almost not so much like a Bigfoot, more like the skunk ape of Florida, where, in other words, it's more like an athletic, thinner looking animal with these glowing eyes, jumped out and jumped onto the back of his cart. He was pulling a horse and cart at the time and frightened the horse half to death, and the horse went galloping down across the bridge. And of course the man followed it, and the creature just vanished. And since that time there have been a number of reports at this particular bridge of this strange creature. Now we have similar reports all across Britain of these Bigfoot type creatures. One of the things I would say, and it does get into controversial areas, which, you know, I don't apologize for shying away from. I think, you know, if there's controversial areas, we should look at them. But a lot of the British reports seem more paranormal than they do purely flesh and blood. There are, for example, stories of these sort of spectral apes vanishing and appearing in the blink of an eye, or having self-illuminating glowing eyes. And a lot of them are seen around ancient structures. Not so much Stonehenge, but similar ones, where there's a lot of stone circles in Britain and ancient hill forts, as they became known, that were built 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. And we get a lot of reports in these specific areas. Now, of course, people say, well, if these are purely physical flesh and blood animals, why would they be seen in such areas? They would be seen at random. But it's almost like they're not seen at random. So there's no doubt in my mind that there's a British Bigfoot phenomenon. I'm not entirely convinced that it exactly falls into the same realms as, like, the abominable snowman, for example, of the Himalayas and things like that. It does seem more, or it has a paranormal aspect to it rather than just a flesh and blood aspect.
See, that's something that's always interests me, because you know, a couple weeks ago we had your buddy Ken Gerhard on.
Oh, yeah.
And, we touched a little bit on the idea that, you know, according to theoretical physics, which is, you know, something that makes me crazy. I love it. According to theoretical physics, that there's a chance that, you know, we live in this multiverse rather than a universe. And some people in the cryptozoological field feel that somehow our world butts up against one of these other universes and a doorway is open and some of these creatures are able to come in, you know, of course being the weirder ones like Mothman. What exactly are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's possible that this British Bigfoot or wild man or whatever, you know, could be one of these creatures that, you know, come across that divide between dimensions?
Yeah, my personal view is exactly what's going on. Now, of course, people, when they talk about, you know, paranormal realms and supernatural realms, my view is that these realms, dimensions, whatever they might be, one day, hopefully, they'll be explainable via science. I think right now, for me at least, things that we call supernatural or paranormal are natural things that science hasn't got an answer for yet, but it doesn't mean there isn't a scientific answer, you know, that could explain how portals and doorways could exist. And so one of the reasons why I think the British Bigfoot falls into that category, because Britain is a very small country.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually smaller. Scotland, Wales and England combined are actually smaller in square mileage than the state of Texas. But the population is a full 20% of the U.S. population. So if you imagine 20% of the entire U.S. population crammed into Texas.
Mm-hmm.
That's how densely packed Britain actually is. But there are a lot of wilderness areas and large forests. But the problem is, if you have a colony of sort of 6 to 7, 8 foot tall ape-like creatures living in Britain, we would see far more evidence of their eating habits. You know, like, for example, a full-grown silverback gorilla in Africa, in the Congo, gets like through 40 kilos of food a day, and that's just one. you know, if there were a colony of these things breeding in Britain, we would see huge evidence of this, but we don't. What we see is sort of spectral apes coming and going for decades and hundreds of years in certain specific locations that have historic and archaeological significance. So I suspect that ancient man constructed some of these old formations in areas where they recognized that there were, as they saw them, sort of magical portals. And possibly we've forgotten, as you know, in our modern era, what a lot of things ancient man may have known. And possibly they built these constructions in the locations where these weird creatures were seen. And today the creatures still come through, but we've forgotten or lost the knowledge of why that is.
Right.
That's interesting. Well, you know, I think Rick sort of presented it as a multiverse thing. I actually think it's related to the folded dimensions of the universe, which, you know, theoretical physics and quantum physics has borne out that we actually have a bunch of folded dimensions in this universe. And that changes how we perceive things, because if we're trying to perceive things from dimensions that are folded up that we don't have the capability of with our three-dimensional perspective, then all sorts of things could be out there that we just don't get.
Yeah,
I think it's like, you know, when people talked centuries ago how the earth was flat, no one could conceive the earth of being round, because why don't you fall off, you know? And people didn't understand the concept of gravity, and I think it's the same now. My view is that, you know, dimensions may be the equivalent of sitting in your car, you turn the radio on and some classical channel comes on, and for me at least, it's, oh my God, you know, let's change it to something else, you know, and you tune into another channel. And I think that's what's going on, is that these entities, whatever they might be, they have an innate ability to, in simple terms, retune the channels, you know, and they jump in their dimension to ours, if you like.
Well, that would definitely, you know, betray a level of higher intelligence concerning these creatures, if this, you know, in fact is true.
Well, you know, I think it's often our personal prejudices, where if we see like a large, or we hear stories of large 7 to 8 foot tall ape-like animals covered in hair with long fangs or whatever, we automatically assume they're savage animals. It may well be that mentally they're actually very developed, but they look like animals.
Right.
You know, that's not to denigrate animals. You know, a lot of animals are, in their own way, extremely clever. And I think that could apply to these creatures. Maybe, you know, it's our, as I said, our prejudices that we think of them as just, oh, they're just dumb apes. You know,
right.
I think that's that says a lot about our ego as a species than it does anything else. And I think that's one of the important things to remember. They may actually be highly developed, even psychically, possibly.
Yeah, that's you know, that's something I wanted to touch on. You know, within our country, you know, according to Native American lore, I grew up in a mixed race family. My dad's side of the family is Native American, and I grew up with the you know, with Cherokee lore, with the Thunderbird and the Little Men of the Hills, and we appear to have that in our country as well, in the United States, where there are places of power where, take Sedona, for example, or Devil's Lake, which is very near me up in Wisconsin. You know, just like in England, there appears to be these places of power where these bizarre creatures can just, you know, show up and come through and cause havoc and, you know, do whatever it is that they wish. Do you think that we are in, you know, we as humans are in any kind of danger from these power places and from these creatures that could possibly be coming through?
Well, I'm not sure we're in danger from the places, but one of the things I would say is that I've interviewed a lot of people who said they've been they've confronted these creatures. You know, I mean, literally got walking through the woods and come face to face with one. Now, there's an area of woodland in Britain, where I used to live quite close to, called the Cannock Chase, which is a very large area of forest, which has had everything from sightings of big cats, Bigfoot, werewolves, ghostly black dogs, giant winged creatures, giant snakes, and clearly there's no way they could all be living there, but they are seen there. And a number of the witnesses have said that they almost felt as if these creatures were kind of draining them of emotional energy in some respect. And this is one of the theories that's been put forward, that they come through into our realm or dimension, and that in the same way that we feed on, you know, meat and fruit and vegetables, that they are kind of like a paranormal creature that thrives, like almost like an emotional vampire. that feeds on psychic energy or human energy. And I've heard this on countless times where the people have felt that these creatures were sort of very negative towards them, and they felt they were trying to get almost into their body and drain them. Now, you know, if you imagine that there could be a creature or a whole variety of creatures that are doing this, well, you know, one of the arguments is that if they want to drain us of energy, they would, the best way to do it would be to generate high states of energy, in other words, scare us, and then feed upon that high state of emotion. And how would they do that? Well, they'd have to be ensure that they keep being seen by us to scare us and then feed on us. And maybe that explains why people are always seeing Bigfoot crossing the road and things like this in the woods. You know, maybe the Bigfoot maybe Bigfoot only exists when people see it, you know, or in terms of, you know, that it has to be seen to exist, because it kind of feeds, it needs that psychic feeding, if you like.
Right.
So you definitely seem to think that some of these swamp apes and that type of creatures are multidimensional. How about things like Loch Ness Monster? Is that why they scan the lake and they can't find it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the important thing from my point of view, Karen, to stress, is that I think some of the creatures that fall into the realm of cryptozoology are paranormal, however we define the paranormal. Others, I think, are genuine unknown animals that science hasn't classified, or they're animals that science thinks has become extinct and that may not be extinct. So I think, I don't think cryptozoology can be purely put into one category that it's either paranormal or it isn't.
Right.
I think there's several things going on. And like with the big cats in Britain, there's no doubt that some of those are real animals. And a lot of them, I'm sure, have been released by people who owned them and couldn't look after them when they got too big. You know, it was like the owner came from being the keeper to the pet almost, and they just had to get rid of them. Right. They didn't want to have them put to sleep. They didn't want to give them up to a zoo, be put behind bars, so they went out late at night and released them into the woods. So,
wow, how are you responsible?
Well, unfortunately, yeah. But I do think that's what's happened. So I think there's several categories of creature that fall into the realm of cryptozoology, some physical, some paranormal, maybe some weirdly somewhere in between as well.
Right. Yeah, Nick, you seem to be intricately involved with dealing with disclosure in England, and do you do it in this country as well, trying to get our government to fess up and say, hey, look, you know, these things really exist. You know, UFO, speaking of UFOs and, you know, alien visitation, do you get a warm reception or pretty much a cold one when you talk to the Ministry of Defense or, you know, the Department of Defense in this country? How do they treat you? Do they treat you like a quack or, you know, somebody to be taken seriously?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's my other big interest, apart from cryptozoology, is the UFO subject. And what I've found is something that's sort of pretty typical on both sides of the Atlantic, is that you have an admittance that, yes, government agencies at some point have looked into the UFO subject, but we didn't find much. Okay, we got the occasional weird report, and we've released all the documentation into the public domain for people to see. That's sort of the, you know, the picture we get on both sides of the coin, so to speak. But, you know, the more you dig into it and you speak to, for example, old-timers from the military, it's clear that the governments in both Britain and America and other countries as well haven't clearly released half, you know, maybe even 10% of the information they've got.
Right.
The biggest stumbling block that we face is how we access that information when the government itself says it doesn't exist. You know, if they said you cannot have this information because it's classified, that would be a significant statement in itself that we could follow up on. When they actually say we've searched and we cannot find anything, or we don't have anything, period, it's almost like, you know, how do you get in, how do you get past that point? And I think that's the frustrating thing that faces a lot of people who do UFO research. You know, we speak to, say, 70 or 80 year old guys and women who retired and who say, you know, hey, 50 years ago, I typed a report on an alien autopsy in the Pentagon.
Right.
But you just get a blanket denial that such an event even occurred. It's how do we prove it? That's the problem. It's not that we don't have credible witnesses and testimony. It's just that, unfortunately, even I have to admit this, government agencies are so good at hiding information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, short of actually breaking in, which would be probably impossible to do anyway, and probably not the wisest thing to do. You know, right. How do you prove it? That's what we're facing, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I've talked to Stanton Friedman about some of the research that he's done. Project Blue Book, is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it actually seems like he may have come across some fairly credible reports. What do you know about the Project Blue Book stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that a number of government agencies in the U.S. over the years have looked very deeply into the UFO subject. Now, the Air Force actually had four projects, Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Twinkle, and Project Blue Book. Now, the overriding conclusion was that, well, yeah, we've had a few strange reports, even reports from the military, where they tracked things on radar and sent aircraft up, but the pretty much the conclusion was, if we had more data, we could solve those cases as well. But there's no doubt, if you look into some of the reports, that they were clearly overreacted in terms of trying to come up with explanations, where, for example, you had a radar operator tracking an object traveling at fantastic speeds, and then you had a pilot in the air simultaneously seeing this huge disc-shaped craft, and then the official conclusion is everybody mistook a weather balloon.
You know, right.
They were just trying to dismiss the stories. But we have got a number of those reports now in the public domain from Britain, Russia, America, Australia, France, where probably 4-5% of all the reports that are declassified actually are pretty interesting, but there's no sort of definitive smoking gun, if you like.
Right.
And I think the smoking guns are what the government is hiding. And the big question is how we get over that hurdle of not being given access to that material.
Right. So as you were talking, it just popped into my mind, and it's sort of apropos of nothing, but it's kind of a UFO. What do you think about this supposed contrail or missile or whatever it was off the coast of Los Angeles earlier last week?
Well, I mean, that was sort of really interesting. It looked odd. I mean, I've followed the story extensively over the last week, and I think the important thing to remember is it's still early days. You know, there are people who are on one side of the fence and people who are on the other. I think the interesting thing is some people who said it's truly anomalous are actually people who have military backgrounds and credentials, and they're not buying the government's party line. You know, they are saying this looks like some sort of missile or, by definition, a UFO, in the sense we don't know what it is.
Right.
So, you know, I'm hopeful that, like in some other UFO cases, bear in mind it's only a week old.
Right.
You know, as time progresses, maybe we'll get more answers. But I am encouraged by the fact that not everybody in the official world is towing the official line. So.
Right.
Now, Nick, do you believe that there really is a concerted effort by the governments of the world, most likely, you know, the United States as well as the British government, that that there is a cover up to, you know, to keep us mere mortals in the dark concerning alien visitations? Do you think there is a cover up?
Well, I do think there's a cover up. What I'm not convinced that it's a cover up instigated by, quote, the government as such. What I suspect is that it's probably something along the lines of an unofficial, almost like back in the 80s, you know, when you had the old Iran-Contra thing.
Right.
You had these people in the Reagan administration where they weren't an official body, but, you know, they were channeling arms from one group to another. And it was very much unofficial, but they had sort of black budget under the table funding. So, you know, I suspect there are people in the CIA and the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency and Air Force, etc., who know the truth and are privy to the truth and are hiding it. But it may not be, quote, the CIA or the Air Force as sort of unified agencies that are hiding the facts. It
that,
could be like
that's a lot
like
of people keeping secrets, though.
Well, yeah, that's.
I actually think it could be like a cabal of people who, are, when you get to a certain position in certain agencies, you may be briefed. You know, it could be. You know, I think a lot of people think if you join the CIA, you know, you're immediately briefed on what happened at Roswell. I don't think that's the case at all. I think certain people who it's felt may be able to offer something to the whatever the UFO project is, maybe invited into it. And I think it could be like an under-the-table funded group, and they're the ones hiding the data. And it may ironically be the case that when the Air Force itself as a unified entity says, you know, we've looked for files on Roswell, but we can't find them, they may not be lying. It could be that there's like another deeply buried group, and they're the ones who've actually got all the files, and the Air Force, you know, ironically, is as much in the dark as we are, because even they don't know this other group exists, possibly.
Interesting.
So is it possible that there could be, you know, a group like Majestic 12 who are actually in charge of this?
Yeah, I mean, whether it's called a Majestic 12 or not is sort of a moot point, but I think that's exactly what it is, that there is a group very, very deeply buried in the intelligence community, in the military, that is probably answerable not even to the president, that gets its funding through under-the-table sources, and that's how the secret's kept, because Congress, it's not subject to congressional oversight like the CIA and the NSA and the FBI are. It's actually almost like a secret government, I think, if you like, that's operating in tandem with the real government, but obviously on a much more restricted scale, and hiding this information. So.
I'm probably going to get a knock on my door when we're done with this interview. Mr. Hale, could you come with us, please?
Oh, you know what? That's what I was always afraid was going to happen after I interviewed Stanton a couple of times, as I thought, oh, God, they know about me now. I've talked to Stanton Friedman, but so has everybody else, so it's all good.
Yeah. There you go.
Now, I'm sorry, Nick, please. Go ahead.
No, we're just going to say, if the men in black do knock on your door, that actually proves that you're looking in the right direction. Otherwise, they wouldn't be harassing you. So.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
The good old men in black. You know, you touched briefly on gathering files and information concerning the UFO cover-up. And one of your fellow countrymen, Gary McKinnon, was actually successful in doing this. And now, I understand the fact that he actually lost his battle for extradition. He's going to be brought to this country and possibly put on file. Do you think that Gary McKinnon's actions are in fact illegal and should be punished to the furthest extent of the law? Or do you think of him more as kind of like a hero of the cause?
Well, the Gary McKinnon story, I didn't actually realize. I thought the last thing I heard was that he was going to be subjected to another review as to whether he's got to be brought to the U.S. or not. I didn't realize. Is it now actually going ahead?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, I believe he is going to be brought to this country.
For people who aren't aware, Gary McKinnon was sort of very brilliant, or still is, very brilliant computer hacker. And he... a few years ago, developed an interest in the whole disclosure movement and heard a number of stories about how supposedly NASA was hiding top secret information on UFOs and thought to himself, well, if it's been hidden, why don't I go and look for it? Mm-hmm. And as someone who was sort of very skilled in computer hacking, that's precisely what he did. And he claimed to have seen files on some strange terms that were described as non-terrestrial officers, which he concluded might mean that NASA or somebody in the U.S. military or government was operating like a secret space program almost that was sort of hiding underneath NASA's banner, you know, that was doing far more than NASA ever publicly admits to. Now, people often ask me about McKinnon. My view is this, that, you know, if you're going to hack into the government, military, and intelligence files of any nation, doesn't matter who it is, from the biggest to the smallest, and you get caught, you're going to get into big trouble. And it's a very reckless thing to do. And, I would not recommend anybody at all to do that. Now, when you ask, do I feel that McKinnon should be punished to the full extent of the law, I think the unfortunate thing is that McKinnon, you know, was somebody who was, you know, he shouldn't have done it. There's no doubt about that. But he was, by his own admission, and everybody admits, he was just looking for UFO information. He wasn't a terrorist or anything like that.
He
wasn't working for North Korea or China or anybody.
Right.
But what I suspect will happen is if he is brought to trial, he'll be treated as like a scapegoat. And what will happen is that he will be subjected almost to, like, terrorism, homeland security-based legislation.
Which is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, whereas instead of just being treated as, he's just one of those UFO guys who did the wrong thing, and let's, you know, let's look at the case from that perspective. What they're going to say is, we're going to use Gary McKinnon as an example of, hey, if anybody else tries it, they're going to get the same sentence as McKinnon. So yeah. I suspect, unfortunately, from Gary's perspective, I hope it doesn't happen. What I think might happen is that his sentence could far outweigh the nature of what he actually did. You know,
right.
if he was like working undercover for the Iranian government and was looking for missile silo code numbers or whatever, that's a totally different thing. And he would be treated, you know, in a fashion relative to that crime. But it's unfortunate in today's climate and the whole war on terror scenario that I suspect, unfortunately, that he may be treated in that fashion to get a message across to other people, unfortunately.
Well, and we don't prosecute intention. Intention really doesn't have anything to do with it. It's whether you do something that they feel is breaking the law or not.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, I think it's the extent to which, not so much the extent to which the law is broken, but the motivation versus the damage done also, or the secret. You know, he didn't give secrets to any foreign power. You know, it's, the ironic thing is that the government says that the stuff he said he found doesn't exist. You know, all this terrestrial, non-terrestrial officer stuff. They say it's just nonsense, you know.
Isn't that interesting? And yet they'll go ahead with prosecution anyway.
Well, I actually wonder, you know, what will happen if it comes to prosecution. You know, it's like it could actually open a can of worms.
True.
If McKinnon says, well, this is what I saw, and then the judge says, well, says to the Department of Defense or whoever, well, prove he didn't see it or show us the evidence. You know, it's like without the evidence that he damaged anything or saw confidential material, how can they prosecute? It's almost like in a murder case, if there's no body, how do you charge the person and successfully prosecute them? If there's no,
if they
don't present the evidence that McKinnon broke in, damaged systems, which is what they're saying, and saw this material that he shouldn't have seen, it makes you wonder to what extent the prosecution would be successful or not.
Yeah, if it doesn't exist, it doesn't exist. So I can't see how they could prosecute. You know, one of the things that that Mr. McKinnon, I believe, was able to find in these documents was about alien abductions. What exactly are your thoughts on alien abductions, Nick? Why, if this phenomenon, I know, Karen, is actually happening, what is it that they want exactly? Why would they come here and steal a Joe Q public like myself out of his bed in the middle of the night and, do whatever to him? What do you think that they want?
Well, you know, I mean, abductions certainly are a strange phenomenon. There's no doubt about that at all. And there's no doubt in my mind that there is a genuine phenomenon. I sometimes sort of go back and forth between different scenarios. One, of course, is the literal physical abduction of people by extraterrestrials for the scenario that we hear about, namely they're coming from some dying planet or where their bodily makeup as a civilization is kind of like on an evolutionary decline, and so they try and, I guess, boost the stock in simple terms with the addition of literally like new blood, you know, namely us, and that's why they take, you know, eggs, sperm, DNA, etc., supposedly. Now that in itself, I guess, is plausible because it might, you know, it's the way we treat lab rats. The only thing that I'm kind of suspicious about, which almost sounds too convenient, is that we would be so compatible DNA wise with creatures from, you know, however many galaxies away. You know, we're just, you know, that they can actually use our DNA to boost their stock. It's almost like us taking the DNA from, I don't know, a grasshopper, you know, and saying, oh, yeah, that's compatible. You know? That's one of the things I find kind of challenging. Now, the other argument, of course, about abductions is that the whole angle of the abduction is like a screen story or cover story for something else. You know, there are stories, for example, about abductees being implanted or given subliminal messages.
Yes.
Yeah. Almost along the lines that, you know, they're creating like a sleeper race of people who are going to be turned on at some point to do some task on their behalf, which may not be to our benefit, and that the whole abduction medical experiment is a cover, you know, for, you know, in other words, the hybrid race scenario is like a smokescreen to hide the fact that they're manipulating us in some other way.
Oh my gosh, I have to tell you, when I listen to, when we interview people, nobody ever freaks me out, and you just freaked me out.
I like to freak people out.
Very good. Kudos to you, because it takes a lot.
Outstanding.
I know.
Joking aside, if you imagine, it's almost like in the Cold War, you know, the Russians would send over sleeper spies, as they called them, you know, and be given a new identity, and some woman named, Ivana, whatever, you know, suddenly turns up in mid-America and her name's Sally Smith or whatever. And she marries an American guy who's in the military, and, you know, he tells her a few stories after a few drinks one night about what they're doing at the base. She reports back to her handler in Moscow. You know, you have that sleeper-type people.
Right.
You know, people do wonder sometimes with abductions if that's what we've got. We have, like, an unconscious group of people being built up that are all, you know, subliminal messages are in the heads of the abductees. And one day, the switch will be thrown, and they'll be almost like zombies. You know, it'll all be most like a controlled herd of people who are going to do the bidding of the aliens, because they've been, something's been done to them when they were abducted, and they have this subliminal message to suddenly all follow the, you know, the whatever the aliens want them to do, kind of like a UFO equivalent of like Night of the Living Dead or whatever.
That is unpleasant.
Yeah, I mean, especially with a cat like me, man, I absolutely fear zombies. But
I love zombies.
you brought up the idea of alien implants. I wanted to go back on the sexual nature, but I wanted to talk, since, you know, you talked about implants already. These implants and that people claim to be having, and these abductees or experiencers, as they like to be called now, you know, they seem to be coming out and going to one specific person to have these implants removed, Dr. Roger Lear, who is actually a podiatrist by trade, I guess you could say, which I find really interesting that he's doing surgery on people to get these out. But these implants, do you think that there's any validity to these stories, people claiming to have these implants inside of them?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people report that. I mean, they report, for example, kind of being laid out on almost like an examination table, and strange devices, you know, placed up their nostrils or in their ears, and a feeling, at least, that something has been implanted in them. Now, there's no doubt that in some abductees, you know, items have been taken from the bodies, which, you know, that the witness or the person has concluded or thought could be connected with the abduction and some sort of implants. Now, what I would say is that one thing to be aware of is that, for the most part, if not exclusively, all the items that have been removed from people's bodies look completely different to the others.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to say it's not a valid phenomenon, but it, you know, when each so-called implant looks totally different, you know, I do sometimes wonder if it's simply the case that, you know, Joe Smith, who has something removed at 35, when he was 5 years old playing outside with his friends, you know, he stubbed his toe on something and got a bit of stone in there, and it calcified and stayed in his foot for 30 years.
Sure.
Right.
You know, and forgot about it. I think, you know, we all do, you know, as kids, you sort of rough and tumble and fall over and cut yourself, and, you know, all sorts of things happen. And who knows what collects in your body over the years, you know.
Right.
You eat a meal, and there's something, you know, everybody, I'm sure, at some point has done that, where you swallow a bit of bone, or maybe a bit of fork breaks off, you know, and it gets inside you, and it doesn't dissolve, but it gets absorbed into your body wall or whatever. I think we need to be careful and differentiate between what might be something anomalous in someone's body and something that got there purely and simply via, you know, everyday wear and tear, so to speak.
You kind of touched on the whole sexual or reproducing reproduction angle concerning alien abductions, and one alien abduction in particular comes to mind, and that was of the Brazilian farmer Antonio Vias Boas. I think that was back in 1957. From what I understand, with a lot of people who are abducted, most specifically women, when they're abducted, many times over time, they're actually presented with children. They look like a hybrid between extraterrestrial as well as human. And of course, you know, we have the whole thing in our you know, this country of, you know, the South. Well, the alien stole my baby, you know, or whatever. Now, if this, in fact, is going on, like with the case of Vias Boas, where he was, you know, shown his, I believe it was his daughter, do you think that they're doing this to either strengthen their own people, or, you know, trying to propagate their own race again? Which do you think it could possibly be?
Well, I mean, it could be a combination of two. One of the things I would say about Vias Boas was that he was undoubtedly the luckiest abductee ever.
No shit, right? I'm sorry, no kidding, right?
I mean, his alien space woman actually looked like a woman, not like some bug-eyed praying mantis.
Yeah, from what I understand, you know, she was pretty hot, too, so...
Yeah, that's right. Vias Boas is one of the few abductees who deserves, like, a high five or whatever, so... But joking aside... There's no doubt that, you know, people do report this sexual, like hybrid crossbred angle to abduction stories. Mm-hmm. Now, again, the general story that is sort of fed or almost like projected into the minds of the abductees is that this is being done because the aliens are dying, and if they can crossbreed with us, at least it gives their race a chance of some chance of survival, if you like, even if it means, you know, being crossbred with us. Mm-hmm. The other scenario that a number of researchers subscribe to is that, yes, they're crossbreeding with us, but not because their race is dying and needs to be saved, but because they want to, again, kind of going back to this infiltration angle, that they want to create almost like an army of aliens that can actually pass for looking like us. And right. Move amongst us, and even secure positions of power. You know, this gets into sort of really paranoid, weird areas. The idea that if the aliens crossbreed with us enough, and so you have a first-generation hybrid that then crossbreeds with a human, then you have a second generation that crossbreeds with a human. After three or four generations, you may have something that looks very human, but with a few oddities where you might look at the person twice in the street and think, okay, but it's a human, but they might have like a weird genetic thing going on with them. But actually, maybe it's like a form of infiltration that they're not here to save themselves. They're actually trying to make themselves look more and more like us so they can infiltrate us and then ultimately, you know, before we know it, takeovers occurred, if you like.
Oh, sorry, Karen, please.
Yeah, well, if you had a question about what he's talking about, because I was going to change the subject to high strangeness, so... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, well, you know, with that being said, what are your thoughts on David Icke and his, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, and his theories concerning that, you know, the reptilians are here and they look like us because they've been interbred with us? What are your thoughts concerning that? Do you think that there is a conspiracy to, you know, one day turn us into food?
Well, you know, I mean, I've never seen evidence of that conspiracy. What I have done is spoken to a lot of people who claim to have met reptilian-type humanoids. I mean, I've interviewed a number of so-called abductees who've said that they've seen the so-called greys, these little guys with the big heads and the black eyes, on little craft. And these larger reptilian types are kind of looming in the background as if they're almost overseeing things. And the little gray guys are almost like the worker bees or something like that.
Right.
So, you know, I don't dismiss at all. In fact, I think it's a valid aspect of the phenomenon that there are these reptilian entities. Now, for me at least, it's a big leap to say we're seeing these reptilian entities because they're part of this, you know, hierarchy, and that ABC is going to happen to us, etc., and the British royal family are all reptilians. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would need to see evidence that the Queen is like a flesh-eating reptile. I'm not going to hold my breath waiting to see that, because I don't think it's going to happen. But that
I don't know. Prince Charles is kind of a weird-looking dude.
But I don't. That doesn't take away the undeniable fact that a lot of people have reported experiences with reptilians. So again, I think it's like with abductions. We know there's a phenomenon. We know there are reptilians. For me, the jury's still out on what the nature of their involvement in the whole phenomenon is.
Huh. Right. Okay. Karen, you had a question?
I just wanted to know about high strangeness, because I know that high strangeness sometimes surrounds cases of alien abduction, and it's never really made a lot of sense to me, so I wondered if you could shed some light on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people think abductions are just along the lines of, oh, somebody's taken from their bed, you know, or a car, and transported to a UFO. They get prodded, poked, DNA taken, and then brought back, and their memories wiped clean until they start having weird nightmares and then have hypnotic regression and remember it. But we find a lot of really strange, I guess, offshoots to abductions. A lot of abductees have reported, for example, poltergeist-like activity in their homes, which, you know, I have no way to explain that unless, as some people think, you know, there's like a demonic angle to abductions, that these creatures aren't alien, that they're literally like occult beings, you know, demonic entities, you know, if you believe in demons, of course.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to interject with that. I've actually had members of my family who are, you know, super hyper conservative, born again Christians and all. My uncle actually said that to me one time, that these things that people are seeing flying around are actually demons trying to confuse and, you know, steal, you know, God's good people away from him or whatever. But yeah, I mean, yeah,
I mean, I don't personally subscribe to that theory, but there are quite a few people, not just in the UFO field, but in mainstream religious fields, who think that UFOs are like a demonic deception, and that we're being lulled into a false sense of security. Now, you know, that they're literally trying to infiltrate us with demons, if you like. Now, there are cases where people have, you know, said that they had weird poltergeist-like activity in the house after abduction experiences, which is, you know, definitive high strangeness. There are other people who've developed or experienced strange synchronicities after abductions. You know, things like this, where you have to wonder, well, if this was purely just a scientific sort of reconnaissance mission by aliens, why 2 weeks after the experience would you be having poltergeist activity in the house, you know?
True.
Unless there's some sort of scientific aspect that we don't fully understand yet, which is entirely possible. You know, we're kind of looking at things with 21st and 20th century physics and science, that may be...
True. It could be a dimensional thing or something, yeah?
I mean, this is one of the things some people think, that, you know, this sort of poltergeist activity could be like a... almost like a... after the experience occurs, you know, like a hangover type scenario, I don't know, literal hangover, but where something remains, like a residual aspect of the invasion from some other dimension, and it has residual effects in the household that we perceive as, you know, psychic or paranormal or whatever, but it may be just like a you know, a purely scientific-based residual energy or something like that.
Well, that's actually pretty fascinating. I think if that is in fact the case, do you think it's possible that because of there's somebody in the household that is psychic or whatever, or, you know, has that kind of energy, that could be the reason why these creatures are attracted to them? Do you think that's possible?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think, you know, there's no doubt that. There's no doubt in my mind, at least, that, you know, the human mind is capable of far more than we normally realize. And unfortunately, it's very difficult for most of us, if not the majority of us, to harness those powers. You know, there's certain people who exhibit ESP, psychic phenomena, precognition, things like this. And mm-hmm. I think possibly to an extent we can all do it if we know how to do it. And I actually do believe that ancient man thousands of years ago definitely knew how to do it.
Paul, I could not agree more.
Yeah, and I think we've, unfortunately, as we've developed technology-wise, we've actually lost a lot, you know, spiritually-wise, spiritually in terms of, you know, the capabilities of the mind, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think possibly these entities can, you know, target, maybe there's a way of recognizing that there are certain people who, you know, quote, I guess almost like chosen ones, you know, without going down that sort of connotation, but the idea mm-hmm. that there are certain people who are more useful for their task, if you like, because their brains are more wired, whereas the rest of us, our brains are rewired or whatever.
Right. Well, we kind of talked, we had Barry Fitzgerald on a couple weeks ago, and, you know, he was another really fascinating guy. And he kind of touched on that a little bit, too, that, you know, when it comes to, like, psychic phenomenon, that there are some of us who have, you know, certain kind of minerals or whatever in our bodies that opens us up to that kind of thing. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is I know that, you know, you're very much involved in cryptozoology and ufology. What are your thoughts concerning ghost, you know, supernatural research, more or less?
Well, you know, I think, like the UFO subject and cryptozoology, I think there's probably several explanations. I do believe that some, quote, ghostly phenomena could be like a residual energy, you know, of something mm-hmm. that gets left behind. Now, whether that energy has actually any intelligence to it, you know, the equivalent I often use is, you know, the idea that you put bread in the toaster and you make toast and you burn it, and 10 minutes later somebody comes in the house and you can smell the burnt toast. Well, the toast, if yeah. it's already been eaten, doesn't exist anymore, but there's a residual energy of that toast, you know, in
right.
the smell. Now, I sometimes think that some ghost sightings could be almost, you know, that's a very simplistic analogy, but the idea that some ghostly energy could be some sort of residual phenomenon that gets left behind. But, of course, mm-hmm. that doesn't explain, you know, contact cases where, for example, someone's woken up in the middle of the night and seen their father at the edge of the bed or whatever, and then they get mm-hmm. the phone call to say their father died, you know, an hour earlier.
Right.
There are a lot of stories like that which are simply not explainable in that category. And that does, to me, suggest some sort of survival of, however you want to term it, the soul, the essence. You know, I do specifically try and steer away from specific, you know, religious belief systems because I don't know what the truth is, other than I think certain, you know, I do believe something survives death, but I think mm-hmm. lots of cultures and religious groups have put different interpretations on what that means. But I do think there's some, I mean, me and my wife actually had a very strange series of incidents occurred back in 2003 when our dog died, like smelling really strong wet dog smell in the house days after mm-hmm. she died, and even hearing mm-hmm. like claws pattering on the corridor floor, on the tile floor, and it
right.
wasn't imagination. Now, some religious teachings, like mainstream Christianity, will tell you that animals don't have souls. Others
yeah.
will say that all living creatures have souls.
Yeah.
Now, having experienced a few things like that, I do believe something occurs after death, but I will be also the first to admit that I haven't really got a firm clue of what it is, only that something happens. It's not avoiding the question, it's just,
oh, yeah.
you know, it's such a baffling area that
right.
I am convinced from what I've seen that something happens to us. Yeah.
Right. Well, according, you know, to some religions, like, you know, like religious structures like animism, for example, not
yeah.
animeism, but
yeah, exactly.
animism, you know, says that all of us have a soul. And I mean, me personally, I'm a Buddhist, so mm-hmm. I see that, you know, we all have a spiritual yeah. dimension to us that, you know, eventually, you know, if I don't live a good life, I'm going to come back as a snail,
yeah.
which, you know, hey, I suppose is fine. But with all the, you know, religions in our world, nobody can really agree on any one thing. But I think that's why, you know, people like, you know, Karen, you and I and the rest of us, we keep searching for that best evidence and searching for that best
best evidence more or less to explain where we come from, what we are, where we're going, you know, so forth and so on. So
yeah, and I think there's actually something to be said that, you know, one of the things I have experienced a lot is sort of like synchronicities, where you almost feel you're brought into contact with certain people at certain times.
Yes.
In a fashion that seems beyond coincidence. And I think when that happens, it's almost like there's something ensuring that it guides you down the right path. You know, if that happens to you a lot, I think you're on the right path and something is trying to help push it along. You know, I actually do believe that happens, that synchronicities aren't just random coincidences, that there is like a bigger picture of, you know, making sure we kind of do the right thing and put us in touch with the right people or whatever. But again, what it is, you know, it's that's the big question. So.
Yeah, no, right. I actually agree with you on that. I have, you know, had things happen that just can't be coincidence. Well, I suppose they can, but at some point, coincidence has become so saturated that it seems a little more than that, I would think. Mm. So, right. Rick, I know you had a whole big list of things that you wanted to ask, and we have about 5 minutes left. So, get your best one in there, Hale.
Actually, you know what, Frasier? I pretty much, looks like I covered it all, except for the flying humanoids, and that's like that's a big can of worms that would probably take us another hour or two to touch on. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Well, yeah, probably. I mean, I've investigated a number of reports, you know, flying wing creatures, everything from stuff like things that look like giant pterodactyls to big giant birds to, you know, literal flying humanoids. Again, actually on the Cannock Chase Woods near where I used to live about a year and a half ago, there was a report of somebody said they saw this man-like creature just like soaring across the sky, almost like, you know, some sci-fi film with a jet pack on his back or something like that.
Yeah, you know, actually, where I live, we have reports of that, but they're like, you know, 50 years old or something. But yeah, that's actually one of the things our area is famous for.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Those type of reports are very difficult to explain. And personally, you know, there's a lot you could talk about on that. But personally, I would place those in the same category of these beings coming through from other realms.
Okay.
Possibly like Bigfoot. I think they're kind of something along those lines as well.
Okay, cool.
Last question, Nick. When you're out on, you know, one of your monster hunts or whatever, are you ever afraid of being cornered by one of these things? And, well, you know, Nick no longer exists, but in the form of poop. you ever worry about that kind of thing?
I don't so much get worried. I mean, for me, I get more, maybe it's just my character. I kind of get more fired up when I go on investigations. Now, you know, the number of reports where people have actually been physically attacked by these entities is extremely small, almost to the point of non-existence. But there are, as I said earlier at the start of the show, a lot of reports where people feel almost psychically attacked or drained. That's not happened to me, but I'm always in that kind of mindset that it could. So I don't just get scared. I think you just need to appreciate what could happen and sort of tread carefully. But, you know, I wouldn't want, from my perspective at least, for that to stop me doing what I do. I think unless we look for the answers, we're not going to get them. And, you know, worrying that this or that might happen until it does or if it does.
Right.
We should try and put that out of our minds, because I think sometimes a negative mindset can actually draw in a negative reality.
I agree. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, I don't know that you're absolutely right on that, but that's what I think too.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, with that, I think that's kind of like what my wife, who, you know, by the way, thinks I'm a, you know, super colossal dweeb with all this stuff.
You are.
But thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
But she's actually kind of like afraid that when I go on a ghost investigation, which is something I do quite a bit, I work with a really large group here in Northern Illinois. She's afraid of me coming, either bringing something home or being possessed by some evil spirit. And I just tell her, you know, it's like, and I have you saying it now, Nick, that it's like, man, if you go in there with a negative mindset, you're just going to attract this stuff.
You're bait.
Well, you know, I'm sure, you know, you would agree, Rick, with your, you know, your Buddhist background, that it's, you know, it's the whole issue of, you know, what you do right now has an effect on, you know, what can happen in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, karma is a bitch, man.
That's the point. Yeah, that's the point, you know, I'm making, is that if you go into something thinking along these lines or doing that, it has like a spiraling effect further down the line. And, yeah, you know, I think, you know, it's like if you wake up on a Monday morning and think it's going to be, oh, God, it's going to be a typical Monday. Lo and behold, right, it turns out to be a typical Monday.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, you bet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Nick, is it nickredfern.com? Is that what your website is, if people want to go to learn more about you? Okay, and...
Yeah, I actually have a friend of mine who's updated it right now, so there's going to be a few periods over the next week or two when it might be up and down. So.
Okay, and tell me what's coming up next for you. Do you have any new books coming out or any new projects you're working on?
I do. I've got a new book out in about 2 weeks. It's called The NASA Conspiracies, and it's all about conspiracies involving NASA. To do with UFOs, alien sightings, astronaut sightings of UFOs, and things like that.
I have to tell you, I have a real interest in NASA and the space program because my husband's uncle was Dick Scobie, who was the Challenger pilot. So,
no way, really?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And well, yeah, except that he blew up when the you know. But so we, as a result, we sort of have a pretty big interest in NASA and the space program in our house. So I'll look forward to. I'll have to pick that up. Look forward to reading it.
I've actually got a bit in the book. The FBI declassified a file a few years ago that addressed the way in which the FBI, when Challenger exploded, a number of people approached the FBI saying that they thought it was a deliberate explosion or that terrorists were involved. And there's like a huge FBI file that's now been declassified on it. So I've included that in the book as to how they wrote most of the theories off as just, you know, they didn't think they had any merits and it was a genuine accident. But they actually dug very deeply into the claims that, for example, somebody said it was hit by like a laser-guided missile and all sorts of things.
Wow.
Oh, I'll look forward to reading that then. That'll be really interesting and my husband will be interested in that as well. Fair. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, then, so it's nickredfern.com if anybody wants to hear more. And tell me the name of your book one more time.
Well, the new one out in 2 weeks is The NASA Conspiracies.
Okay, great. And it'll be available wherever books are sold, I would imagine, right?
Wherever books are sold, online or in stores, hopefully, as well. So.
Very good. Nick Redfern, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick, for coming on the show.
Sure, thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
Did you know that you can talk to your favorite show hosts from the ZTalk Radio Network? Check out the forum and see what it's all about at ztalkradio.com.
Identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ztalkradio.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. We are live again. This is your host Karen Frazier and Rick Hale with Paranormal Underground Radio. I put you first that time, Karen. You did. I did.
I take back everything I said about you.
So anyways, we just got done listening to a really fascinating conversation with Nick Redfern. I really hope that he'll come back again and, you know, talk some more. He's a really cool cat.
Yeah, interesting guy.
Well, right now, next, we have Michael Kravchek. He's a fellow Chicagoan. And what are you going to be talking with us about tonight, Michael?
The full spectrum camera by Modotronic, and we're going to touch on the shadow person that we caught at a bar in Chicago called mm-hmm. Flounders. So,
yeah, I saw that video, dude, and that video was just phenomenal. You know, I oftentimes talk about the thing that pushed me over when I was 18, and that is exactly what it looked like when it appeared before me. Huh. Very cool stuff.
Huh. Yeah, it was definitely one of those, in the midst of doing evidence review.
Yeah.
And, you know, immediately Kathy called me up and said, you've got to see this. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Let's get right to it then.
You know, I know that Andy Selfridge had talked about this about a month or so ago, but I wanted to bring this up again, especially after the video that we had captured. You know, the theory out there is that spirits reside outside of our field of vision, either in the infrared or in the ultraviolet spectrum. So the theory goes that if we have a full spectrum camera, that we should be able to catch this phenomena either as it's happening or after later on in our evidence review. And the Modotronic camera that's out there right now, it's actually been out probably for at least 6 or 7 months. And, you know, it was actually mm-hmm. out several months before it even appeared on Ghost Hunters. And essentially, I mean, they took a $120 camera from SVP, which is Silicon Valley Peripherals, and it's a high-def camera. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a bad little camera in its own right. But what they did was they removed the hot mirror off of that, which essentially allowed it to see deeper into the infrared spectrum. And then what they did mm-hmm. they added a visible spectrum filter. So calling this camera a full spectrum is kind of misleading, but they did it for a reason, because if you saw in the full spectrum, it would pretty much wash out the entire video that you're getting with it.
Right.
So essentially what they're giving you is the ultraviolet, and they're also giving you the infrared with this camera. Mm-hmm. And if you look on my site, if you're curious as to how this thing shoots at night, I did do a lab test with it, and you could see compared with my Sony. I mean, obviously this camera, quality-wise in terms of the body and everything, probably isn't the same quality as a $2,000 camera. But the video footage mm-hmm. that it shoots is actually quite good. And if you do use it with either an infrared light, which it's great in IR, or mm-hmm. if you use it with a pretty powerful ultraviolet source, the camera is pretty neat. So feel free.
How does it do with those full spectrum lights, like the one that Paul Bradford sells, and it's the name of it, the Phantom Light, things like that.
Yeah. I actually, you know, I don't have that one, Karen, but I do have both of Paul's, his IR flood and his ultraviolet flood, which is kind of the same thing coupled together.
Right.
And with the two, it's pretty bright. It's okay. Pretty bright, and I would say in total darkness, you're going to get about at least 20 feet of coverage, which is pretty darn good.
Okay.
So,
wow.
Go ahead. Okay, so anyhow,
Hello?
Oh. I'm here. So anyhow...
Sorry about that.
My
lag.
My team has had this this camera for a little bit now, and have used it at many different locations, and, you know, this video footage that we caught at a bar called Flounders, and it's in Chicago on Clyburn and Western, and it's got a pretty interesting history here. It actually involves the original sausage baron of Chicago, and we're not talking about Abe Froman.
Mm.
But there's, you know, there's been murders there. There's been
mayhem,
and all sorts of history going all the way back to the late 1800s here. And
now that's the one where the I'm sorry, Mike, but that's the one where the sausage guy ground up his own wife into the meat. Is that how the story goes?
That is correct. Yeah, that is correct. So, yeah, very interesting history. But my team had was out at Flounders and doing an investigation there, and they thought that they had a pretty quiet night. Well, not only did they come back with some interesting EVPs that night, but they also did come back with the video that's on our website, cpiteam.net. And essentially, if I can describe the video, while Kathy's talking, she makes mention about the 30-second mark that, you know, if somebody's there, the guys are up at the front at the bar. And if, you know, they'd like a drink, go up and join them. And you literally see a shadow kind of pulse a little bit, and it literally walks across the screen. And I can't say that, you know, it was definitely... because of the Modotronic camera that we caught this, but Kathy did not see this with her own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's quite obvious by, you know, while she's sitting there and talking that she has absolutely no reaction whatsoever to the shadow. And then the other part of the story is the only light source that she had was the 40 LED UV illuminator that she was using, which was attached to the side of the camera there. So there was absolutely no illumination behind her to cause any kind of a shadow. So pretty neat video.
Cool. All right.
Well, I was just going to say, from what I understand is that the shadow people, they move so fast because they could be moving in and out of our reality where we can't see it, that you really can't see them with the naked eye. It's almost impossible to even to catch them on video, but you guys managed to do so, and that's amazing.
Yeah, I saw one with the naked eye.
I've got to give a plug to Modotronic.
Yeah, I do.
I know there's a lot of detractors that are out there that say, gee, how could they do this for $195? But I'll tell you what, you know, for $195 and to catch that type of evidence, you know, that's a good bang for your buck.
That's right. It's going on my Christmas list.
There you go.
Okay. Hey, are you guys ready to do the lightning round?
I was born ready.
How about you, Michael? Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay, let's get Cheryl and Chad to turn on their mics then. And let's I'm get so it ready. Going.
I'm here.
What?
We're ready to go.
You all sound so enthusiastic. Are the questions really boring for you?
No, I like them.
I think we're a little flat tonight. Well, I know I am. Gosh, but...
Well, Chad is fresh from his extremely doctrinal conversation there.
Oh, my gosh, Chad.
The chat room's a little heavy tonight, huh?
Well, I'm just, you know.
Yeah, really.
That's what I believe. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, okay, you guys ready? Here we go.
Yeah.
So, the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology is going to publish a controlled study by a guy at Cornell University. His name is Daryl Byrne. And what it seems to show is that there is scientifically valid evidence in this study that precognition is real. This was in New Scientist Life here this past week. So what's interesting is that the psychology experts have tried to poke holes into his experimental design and his methodology, in spite of the fact that they feel that the outcome of the thing which says that precognition happens is absolutely ridiculous. They can't poke holes in how the study was conducted. My question is this. If this study actually winds up holding water, do you think that the researcher should win James Randi's $1 million challenge? What do you think, Michael?
I'll tell you what. I would leave the $1 million just to have James Randi stand in front of me and say, I was wrong.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
What do you think, Chad?
Sorry.
Okay.
I was on mute. Yes, I think they should, because if they can prove it, I mean, they can prove it, and they can do it, you know, without a doubt, scientifically, whatever, you know, I think it's only fair.
Yeah, the controls were in place, and like I said, scientists are saying this study, the methodology and the way they did it was valid. So what do you think, Rick?
I would love to see them... To see them come out on top, because the not so amazing Randi has been a smug bastard for many years because of it, and I think it's time that he gives up that million, even if he has it.
If he has it at all, huh? Doesn't he have it? Yeah. Isn't it like sitting in an escrow account or something? Or has he just claimed he's had it all these years?
I think he's probably claimed that he's had it all these years. I mean, the guy's a failed stage magician.
Oh, there you go. I know you hold the James, you hold the amazing Randi in high respect. So Cheryl, how about you? What do you think?
Very.
Well, I'm not even sure of the exact details of the James Randi $1 million challenge, but it sounds like if the study is legit, you know, maybe someone should enter it into this challenge. See what happens.
I think they should, because, like I say, they have tried, because people think that it's absolutely ridiculous that this is showing that precognition is a real thing, but they can't discount the way the study was done. So I find that really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's definitely going to be a story to watch and see how it develops. According to MSNBC.com, the Catholic Church just announced this last week that they now have a shortage of exorcists. And so there are a lot of openings currently in the field, a lot of job openings. So I want to know if you have any recommendations for the Catholic Church. Who should they hire, Michael?
I think now that Congress has said that they're not extending unemployment benefits, I think that there's going to be people lined up for this.
Okay, there you go. What do you think, Chad?
How much does it pay?
So Chad is going to get in line for that. Got it. I don't know. I don't know. The Catholic Church probably doesn't pay great, but hey, you would be celibate, and you could look at altar boys, and you would be taken care of for life. It's all good, right? Mm-hmm. So, Rick, how about you? What do you think?
Does it come with dental?
Probably. I think it comes with everything.
Then I'm in.
Including a lifetime supply of holy water. Yeah, lifetime supply of holy water.
Lifetime supply of magic water. That's awesome.
I know. I wonder, do you think people drink holy water?
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? Is that bad, drinking holy water?
Well, if you're thirsty.
Yeah, well, my dogs would use it as a dish. So, Cheryl, what do you think?
Okay, I'm sorry. What was the question again?
Who would you recommend for the job openings for Catholic exorcist?
You know, there's one person who jumps to mind that I think would really kick ass and take names during an exorcism. It's Mr. Ricky Hale.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's okay, because he wants dental insurance, so there you go.
Oh, my God, totally.
Okay.
I'm with dental.
This one is, Cheryl, this one is especially for you, this question.
Hmm.
Last Wednesday, Wired Science reported that life on Earth could have actually come from alien zombies. Now, what the alien zombies were broken remains of alien viruses that, while they were dead, would have contained enough information to generate new life. I didn't really have a question with this. I just wanted to, you know, tell Cheryl that we may have descended from zombies. Oh, so here's the only question I could come up with, and it's actually two questions. What do you think about the possibility of being zombie spawn, first of all, and does it make you crave brains more or less? Michael?
I don't know if it's changing my craving, but I'll make another plug tonight for the new Walking Dead series that's on.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome. That show's so good.
How about you, Chad? You craving brains now? Should Cheryl worry?
No, because I'm going to use her as my bait.
The zombies are going to come, and he's going to push me down and run.
No, he's just bait.
Rick?
Well, I guess those Scottish scientists that I talked about at the top of the show are definitely right.
There you go. Okay. And Cheryl, got a brain craving?
Well, first of all, I have to say that now I'm worried about a sleeper zombie cell, not a sleeper UFO cell. Yeah. So yeah. Now, knowing that they're saying this about where we're originated from, I'm scared. But secondly, and I'm not positive, but I think this might actually explain my need to eat raw fish.
Hmm.
Thirdly,
it's kind of that brain texture.
Does not make me hungrier for brains. Sorry.
Okay. All right. So, also from MSNBC.com, they're reporting that SETI launched a signal searching campaign this week in dozens of countries, and all of these radio telescopes are now pointed at the sky listening for a response. It isn't the first time that SETI's attempted this. The last time was 50 years ago. It's pretty much the same thing all over again. Do you think there's going to be a response this time, Michael?
No, I don't. Not at this time.
Okay. Chad?
I can't even come up with a witty response.
Yeah. Chad?
Well, I think we've already been in contact with them, so what would be the point?
That's right. And there's sleeper cells right here, right now, waiting to become zombies. Rick, how about you? What do you think?
I'm hoping that they beam us their porn.
Do you think the alien porn would be interesting?
Well, three boobs and two penises.
You know. Yeah, there you go.
You can't go wrong.
All right. And Cheryl?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that this is the time that we're going to get a public response, if you will. But we'll get a response one day. I'm just not so sure this is going to be the time.
Yeah, I think they're doing the same thing they did 50 years ago, and it didn't work then, so why would it work now? That's sort of my opinion.
Yeah.
All right. Not that anybody asked. Okay, so on Tuesday, the Washington Post reported that scientists believe they have, for the first time ever, witnessed the birth of a black hole. So what do you think the implications of that are, Michael?
That my ex-wife still exists.
Chad?
Okay. That's something that they basically purported have existed for years, and you know.
Yeah, but they actually saw one being
created. Yeah, but I'm just saying, it actually goes towards, that's what they're supposed to do as scientists, is to prove.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Rick?
I have nothing, sorry.
Wow, we are just a dynamic bunch tonight. Cheryl, yeah. Save us.
Yeah, I think that, okay, what was the question?
Moving on. Okay, so I'm sure everybody can answer the next two. So
no, you're just giving me. Is this the black hole question?
It was the black hole question.
Okay, really quick. We've only had theories about black holes until this point, right? So I think that if they really did witness the birth of a black hole, the data that they're gonna, the information they're gonna get from it is gonna be huge.
So you know what I think? I think that Soundgarden is gonna have to write a whole new song.
Woo!
That's what I think. All awesome. Right. So the last two, I'm sure you guys can answer. The first of the last is that the Daily Mail is reporting that there's a British discount supermarket chain that just launched a line of reindeer meat in time for the holiday season. So here's my question. Is reindeer meat excellent marketing, tacky, Scrooge-like, or something else altogether? What do you think, Michael?
Reindeer meat.
Oh, Chad?
I just feel bad for all the kids that see that. They're like, they're out killing Rudolph. I mean,
Do you suppose that the cans have like little blinking red noses on maybe. Them? Oh my God, that'd be hilarious.
Rudolph in a can.
There you go, Rick. What do you think of Rudolph in a can?
I'm kind of wondering if it's delicious, especially if it does come from the North Pole slaughterhouse run by Santa's main man.
Oh, so it might be kind of sugary or something. You know what I was actually thinking? Reindeer sounds chewy. I don't know. I just think it sounds chewy. So, Cheryl, what do you think?
Well, I think that if their goal is to make children across the world cry, then it's definitely brilliant. Sounds good. Sounds tasty to me, but like Chad, I'm sad for the kids.
Yeah. Okay. So, last question. Japan had, this actually is really fascinating to me because it was bound to happen. Japan has a new pop star, and it's a three-dimensional singing hologram. There's nothing real about her, but she's been giving live concerts to rave reviews around the country. So here's what I want to know. How long before she gets out there and starts flashing her computer-generated privates at the paparazzi and knocking out her computer-generated tour dancer EFED's babies? What do you think, Michael?
I'm looking for it on the web, on the internet right now.
Okay, Chad, how about you? What do you think? How long before she becomes the next train wreck pop star?
Well, I have no idea. I'm drawing a blank on this one because that just sounds like only in Japan you would have something like that.
It's pretty amazing, actually. I think that they have this thing. So, Rick, what do you think?
If she starts hanging out with Lindsay Lohan, then yeah, it should be no time at all before we're seeing like digital vag.
Ooh, digital vag, very good.
We can just call it called digital vag.
You could either call it vaginal or dadge. Okay, Cheryl, what do you think?
I want more 3D singing holograms. That's all I have to say.
Would you pay to go to a live concert? I would.
Sure, heck yeah.
I can't even remember where we were, and it wasn't Disneyland, chat. But somewhere we were that they had these, it might have even been the World's Fair or something, just amazing digital holograms that were stunningly, just what they can do with holograms now is stunning.
Do you think they would be able to do something better than have some singing hologram?
Well, sure, it's going to start hanging out with Lindsay Lohan.
Oh, okay.
Digital vag.
Vag. Vagital. So we have some business to take care of because we, our next show is, or Thursday is Thanksgiving, right?
Yes.
It is.
And so we have in our forum, is it just in our forum, Cheryl?
Yeah, it's just in our forum.
We have in our forum a little poll. If you plan to listen, we're not going to be doing it live because we're all going to be bloated with turkey. So we have a little poll, and who is it that they get to choose between for the Thanksgiving replay? Do you recall?
Yeah, they get to choose between Barry Fitzgerald from Ghost Hunters International, Stan Romanek, who was the person who was abducted by aliens multiple times. Let's see, Ken Gerhard, cryptozoologist. Who else did we have on there, Chad? I'm trying to think. We had Lloyd Auerbach, who's a paranormal researcher. And parapsychologist. And Aaron Goodwin from Ghost Adventures on the Travel Channel.
That's right. So if you want to go
Bill
the
Murphy. Don't forget Bill. Bill Murphy.
Oh, and Bill Murray, yeah. From
Bill Murphy from Fact or Faked Paranormal Files.
And he's actually going to be coming up as a guest again. And then who do we have in a couple of weeks after Thanksgiving? Who do we have coming on? Thursday, but the following.
We have Bill. Bill Murphy's coming back to talk to us again.
Awesome.
So, yeah, okay. He's going to talk to us about his second season of Fact or Faked.
Yep. Any other business we have to take care of, guys?
No, just if everyone wants to visit paranormalunderground.net and take a look at the November issue, that's online, and they can read that for free.
And we have coming up after us Night Views Radio coming up right after us in about 6 minutes. Cheryl's going to play a little bit of music, but if you stick around, you can listen to Night Views. And Rob's in the chat room. He'll tell you who's on the show.
I got a plug.
What?
Go to Disneyland.
Woo, let's all go road trip.
Try to drum up some business.
Watch out for the zombie apocalypse.
I have no plugs tonight. I think I haven't had enough sleep this week or something because I'm really flagging. I'm running out of things to say. Can you believe it? Sorry that we've not been so very exciting tonight. But Nick Redfern was awesome, and come back in 2 weeks, and we'll be awesome again. And everybody have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy holidays.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the ZTalk Radio Network.